Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, today my guests are both women. Both were very well-established career women who suddenly lost their high-profile jobs. And we're going to follow their personal journeys and learn how each took a very different approach but came back stronger than before. My second guest today is award-winning journalist Caitlin Kelly. She wrote for the New York Times and many other high-end publications. She'd traveled around the globe as a freelance reporter, telling stories, yet she couldn't find a job as a reporter after she was unexpectedly fired from her day job as a reporter. We're going to find out what she did to survive, how it kept her sane, and how that led to her latest book. We'll also hear what she'd like to say, in no uncertain terms, to the Big C corporate suite, the corporate suits out there. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Catherine Caputa to the show. She's the author of You Are a Brand and The Female Brand, and her brand new book is called Breakthrough Branding, How Smart Entrepreneurs and Intrapreneurs Transform a Small Idea into a Big Brand. And Catherine is a 20-year veteran of branding and advertising. She served as management supervisor of the iconic I Heart New York campaign. She was also a senior vice president at investment giant Smith Barney and taught at the prestigious NYU Stern School of Business. She's now the president of Self Brand, a brand strategy and business coaching company. She's been featured on CNN, ABC, NBC, in Fortune magazine, the New York Times, and many other publications. And she's joining us today. Catherine Caputa, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here, Vicki.
And I hope I'm saying your last name right. How do you say it?
We pronounce it Caputa. So.
Caputa. Okay, yes. Caputa. Let's get it right.
And spelled with a K, K-A-P-U-T-A.
There you go. All right, so you have this brand new book out called Breakthrough Branding, and there's some really terrific information in here, but before we even talk about this, I want to share your story with our listeners, because you had a very interesting career. You really had built yourself up, got very well established, and then that all changed, and you were forced, as you wrote, to become an entrepreneur.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you were before you lost that job.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've made two major career switches. I started out actually as an art historian, and I worked at the Seattle Art Museum.
That's right. I remember.
Volunteer
yeah.
Park. And I was working on a PhD, and then I decided, hey, this isn't my brand. I had my first personal branding crisis, and I decided to go to New York and look for a job in branding or advertising. And everywhere I went, I was rejected because I was, you know, branded as a Japanese art historian or branded as an academic. And so I got kind of interested in personal branding out of necessity because, you know, Vicki, I discovered if you don't brand yourself, other people will, and they're not going to brand you in the way that you want to be branded. So my first branding transformation was to sell myself into getting a job in advertising and branding in New York, with making that switch, you know, from being a Japanese art historian. And then I had a branding career. You know, I worked at two ad agencies, including, as you mentioned, I Love New York, and then I was a corporate ad director. And after 9/11, along with the couple hundred thousand others that worked in the Wall Street area, I lost my job. And, you know, it was like a terrible time in the economy, like today. And it was kind of like, you know, what am I going to do now? You know, because the kind of job that I had done, you know, working for financial services companies, you know, directing their branding and advertising, most of those companies were suffering and were underwater. And so I had to totally, you know, really look at myself again and figure out, you know, where do I want to go and what can I do and what is my passion? And, you know, just like the first one that was a major switch, this one was too. And I kind of, you know, was a reluctant entrepreneur, but it turned out to be a wonderful thing because I ended up starting a company the next year called Self Brand. And I got involved really coaching people with developing your personal brand. And then when I looked back at my own career, you know, personal branding and soft power were, you know, key skills that helped me navigate my way, you know, to getting that first job, to moving from one agency to the next, moving from the agency side to the client side. So, you know, and then I, you know, started writing, working individually, coaching individuals, as well as, you know, speaking on the topic of personal branding. And then, you know, my new book is on, you know, so a lot of my work is with entrepreneurs. And, you know, Vicki, one of the things I always say is, you know, we're all entrepreneurs now, no matter whether you have your own business or you work in a company, you're an entrepreneur. You got to think like an entrepreneur if you want to survive.
Right, right. Definitely. And back when you started this, there really weren't too many people talking about personal brand back then. So, you know, that was fortunate for you. But, I mean, you still took this and ran with it. I want to talk about a couple of things in particular. And one, well, let's define, first of all, how you define branding, because each person does define it a little differently.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people, the old-fashioned sense is, you know, branding is, you know, your name and your logo if it's a business, you know, it's your image if you're a person. But I really define it much more broadly than that. You know, I think brand and branding is everything you do to develop a clear identity for yourself and what's different and special and the value added that you bring and that only you bring to a business situation. So it's really everything you do. It's not just image. It's not just your network. It's everything you do to build a strong visual identity, verbal identity, and, you know, relationships with your customers, quote unquote. And we've all got customers. If you're in a company, your boss is a key customer, you know, other colleagues are customers, you know, your clients are customers. You really want to cultivate a very wide range of customers and build it just like, you know, business brands do.
Right. And of course, especially today with the economy, this applies to everybody. And as you said before, we're all entrepreneurs right now, whether we like it or not.
Exactly.
When, you know, that companies are getting 900 people apply for the same position, we really do have to make ourselves stand out.
Right.
And there's some great tips in your book for doing that, whether you're starting your own business or whether you're just trying to brand yourself. You talk about a couple of things, soft power versus hard power. And I want to go into this a little in depth if we can, because I think this is really valuable.
You know, I think that we're all brought up thinking, you know, hard power, what I'm calling hard power is really where the power is. And my thesis is, you know, soft power trumps hard power. For a person, hard power is your skill set. It's the jobs that you've had. For a company, you know, it's, you know, the inventory, the products, the cash on hand. That's, you know, the hard tangible things. If you're a person, you can put on your resume, or if you're a business, that's on the balance sheet. But where the real power today is soft power, what I'm calling branding power. For a business, you know, it's your brand that you own. It's the intellectual property. It's your client base and your customer base. It's your, you know, network of alliances. And it's similar for people. You know, soft power is certainly your image and reputation, but it's also much bigger than that. You know, it's your network. You know, it's people having intellectual property and ideas that people associate with you. You know, it's having a vast network of all different types of people. It's having a game plan for success. Mm-hmm. And, you know, soft power is really what you need to survive in today's world.
So tell me, when you went to New York and you made your big transition, and then, of course, you had to do that again when you became self-employed,
right,
what were some of the things you looked at when you went from the assistant curator of the Seattle Museum over to working in advertising, and then again when you went from that to being self-employed?
Well, you know, the first one is I connected the dots for people, because when I first went on interviews, I had all these academic things on my resume and in my elevator speech that I was very proud of, and I discovered that it was taking people in the wrong direction, because people said, you know, what are you doing here? You know, you can't work in an ad agency. You're an academic or you're an art historian. So
right.
I redid my resume and I downplayed or eliminated aspects of my background at the Seattle Art Museum that were too academic. And I emphasized the exhibitions that I worked on that were marketing oriented. And I also defined my brand. not as an art historian, because that's what I didn't want to do anymore, but I defined my brand as a marketer for difficult products. And I likened marketing Asian art museum, Asian art exhibitions as being similar to selling a difficult product, you know, because in the West we're more inclined towards Western art. So I said that Mark and I had specific examples of, you know, exhibitions that I'd worked on. So it was connecting the dots so they could see, oh, she's a marketer and she's marketed difficult products. And that's how I got the first job, you know, at Trout and Reese Advertising.
Right.
And
which is one of the biggest companies. I mean, Trout Reese is very well known.
Yes. Al Reese and Jack Trout went on to write 17 books and each. And, you know, they're very big marketing gurus today. And so it was a great place to land. But see, they listened to my story because they thought, wow. And also, I connected the dots, like working in graduate school. You know, you take a lot of information and you distill it to find out what's important. And I said, in advertising, you need to do the same thing to figure out, you know, what the key driver is for customers.
Yeah.
So you need to make the argument. You know, I talk in the book of thinking outside in. Thinking outside is the person or group you're talking to. And what messages do you need to tell them to get the reaction that you want to get? So you don't want to tell them academic stories. You want to tell them marketing stories that connect the dots for them to where you want to go.
Yeah, we definitely can't assume they're going to get that from your
right.
wonderful resume, no matter how wonderful. We need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with my guest here, who is Catherine Caputa, and her book is called Breakthrough Branding, How Smart Entrepreneurs and Intrapreneurs Transform a Small Idea into a Big Brand. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
I don't know how you do all of those things you do. They're so brand new.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN!
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Beautiful, fit, happily married, and successful. Former executive Linda Krill was the kind of woman who made things happen. But after losing her husband at 57, Krill found herself in the middle of an identity crisis. You won't believe what she did to find herself again. Tune in Monday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for the author of Blind Curves on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Get current weather, traffic, and news. Visit 1150kknw.com and stay informed with Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Oh, so bright.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. We are talking today with Catherine Caputa, who's the author of You Are a Brand, the female brand, and her brand new book, Breakthrough Branding. She is a 20-year veteran of branding and advertising and has been self-employed for quite a while now, forced into that, but enjoying it, I assume, Catherine?
I'm loving it. You know, it's the best thing that ever happened to me.
There you go.
Yes.
Well, I want to talk. There's so much information in the book that I just loved. You know, working partly in that business myself, I was really enjoying the stories that you showed because they really illustrated your points in there. But I had to narrow it down for the purposes of the show here. So there's a couple of points that I wanted to talk about. We just talked about the importance of soft power. And one of the things that I think was really key in the book, the difference between hard power and soft power, one of the things I think you mentioned that was really key is competence over warmth. Just talk
right.
a little about that, if you would.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think we all think in a pitch that, or in business relationships, that the most important thing is coming across as competent. But there's a lot of research that's been done, and a lot of it's out of Harvard Business School, that really the most important thing is to project warmth so that people feel connected to you. And if people feel connected to you and feel that you're warm as a person, they like you and consequently like your ideas, and it's easier to persuade them. So you don't want to go into a presentation with, and which I've seen a lot, you know, with 20, you know, PowerPoint bullets with a lot of rational reasons. You want to hone it down to a fewer, but also, you know, emotional branding is very powerful. Tell a story. Get the emotions in so that people feel connected to you. That's what's really powerful in a pitch or any kind of business situation or you know, social situation, actually.
Yeah, yeah. According to your book, only 3% of women-owned businesses gross over $1 million a year.
Right.
You say a lot of this is because we don't know how to pitch or we don't like to pitch.
Right.
You tell a great story on the really... I think gives a great example of this. Iraqi-British entrepreneur Zaha Hadid. This is a success story. Tell us about
Well, you know, it's an interesting story because, you know, she was born in Baghdad and then moved to the UK and studied architecture and brilliant architectural designs. But for her first 20 years in business, she was called a paper, quote-unquote, paper architect because she'd be pitching and she never won any jobs, you know, so none of her buildings were ever built. And then one day she lost the pitch, and then she started thinking about it, and she sort of realized, hey, she's not fighting hard enough. You know, I talk about the passion of the pitch maker, you know, and
right.
she's not passionate enough, and she's not fighting for ideas more, and when things are being rejected, she's not, you know, stepping up to the plate. And then she kind of realized, you know, her name Hadid, her last name H-A-D-I-D, means iron in Arabic, and she thought, you know, I'm going to develop an iron will, you know, and she started pitching harder, and the whole business changed. And I think a lot of women can be guilty of that, you know, is not realizing, hey, it's a competition, and you want to show your passion and your warmth and your connection and why you want to do this job and why this build, you know, her case, you know, she's an architect.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, today, you know, the Olympics is starting this week in London. You know, she designed the Aquatic Center for the Olympics, one of the premier, you know, global competitions to design things. So she's doing all kinds of big architecture projects all around the world.
Yeah.
So being able to, it's not enough just to be talented and have a great idea. You have to know how to pitch it.
Yeah. Interesting story, because when I was home just a month or so ago, I went to my hometown, my city. It's a very big city where I grew up. And my brother was pointing out to me the new library that's being built, which happens to be a woman, I think she was Norwegian, architect.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a couple of articles on her. And this is a huge library. I mean, it's like 8 or 9 stories high. And she won that on the pitch. Why did she get that? She got it because of her pitch. She was relentless,
yeah,
apparently.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's interesting because, you know, architecture, like so many businesses, it's a male-dominated business. You look at all the major buildings around the world, almost all of them are male architects. So, you know, hey, they don't have any edge on design over women. But, you know, so that's very important to learn how to pitch well.
Yeah. What would you say are the two or three top tips on pitching?
Well, I think one of the things you want to do is connect with the audience. And, you know, I talked earlier about thinking outside in. Think of that particular group, who your competitors are, and what kind of messages can distinguish you from others. It's a very important thing. Number two, you want to tell stories. And I think, you know, you don't want to just have all these facts and figures. Why you? You want to tell an interesting story of how you solved a client problem, or your design did XYZ. So you want to bring them into it and get involved in you and your stories. You know, stories are very powerful branding device and very powerful, you know, in the whole sense of, you know, persuasion. So think outside in and also think of using stories. And third, you know, project your warmth. You want to be one with the audience. So you want to think of clicking with them. You know, people that present well click with the audience. You know, if they're with a few other people or a larger group, you know, they listen, they even kind of mimic some of their gestures. So there's a real sense of being on the same wavelength. So people see you, oh, yes, I can, you know, see this person getting, you know, this assignment or this job because, you know, you're similar.
Yeah. You know what? Talking about mirroring, I'll share a little story here because years ago I was meeting with these guys up at Microsoft and they were so low energy, which is unusual for Microsoft.
Right.
And I'm usually waving my arms around as I talk. And so I was very aware they were low energy. And so I sat on my hands so I didn't wave them around.
Wow.
And then they came back and said I was low energy. So I'm not mirroring anymore.
Right. It sounds contrived, but there's a lot of research that indicates it works. But yeah, so that's interesting.
Yeah. One of the most important lessons that you learned, you said you learned from, I think it was Reese, when you worked with him, was positioning is not what you do with the product or service or your job. It's what you do to the prospect's mind, whether that's a potential customer or your boss. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, you know, it's interesting because we always think, you know, you have to do a big product transformation. And, you know, even describing my situation looking for that first job, I was the same woman who went in the next day with a different resume and elevator speech, but this one wasn't academically oriented. And all of a sudden, in people's minds, all of a sudden now I was a marketer. You know, now I was a marketer of difficult products so they could see me. So the key thing to realize is, you know, not that you don't want to work on your visual identity and packaging yourself in the best way possible, and that's important. But what's most important is understanding what's in the minds of other people and how they see you and others, and figuring out the position that you want to own in the mind, in their minds, and, you know, bringing that to life in the course of your conversation and the way you talk about yourself and your abilities.
Yeah.
So it's a very important dynamic to understand.
Yeah. One thing I want to make sure we talk about before we have to go today, and that is the big idea. And you say that often we're telling too big a story. We need to bring it down. Our idea needs to shrink.
Right. Well, you know, we always hear, you know, entrepreneurs, what's the big idea? You know, they're always looking for the big idea. And, you know, at ad agencies, we'd say that all the time, you know, what's the big idea? And, you know, I say, you know, look for a small idea, you know, small in this, you know, it's counterintuitive, but small ideas are big. Small ideas are the ideas that grow into big brands. You know, small ideas in the sense of being simple, being focused, being relevant, and being different than others. And, you know, here's a new story, and I love this story. When I read about it a few weeks ago, Kevin Systrom developed an app like Foursquare. He called it Bourbon, B-U-R-B-N. Didn't do that well. It was a very complicated app that did, you know, 20 different things and didn't do well. But there was one little aspect of the app, the photo sharing, that a lot of people were using. So he started a new company just based on the photo sharing app, and he called it Instagram. And 9 months out, he sold it for $1 billion to, guess who? You know,
man,
Mark Zuckerberg.
Big old Facebook.
Yeah. So again, it's the small idea. When you focus on a small idea as an entrepreneur, you focus on something that you can tinker with. And frankly, look at Mark Zuckerberg. He started out with Facebook just at Harvard. He didn't go national 2 weeks, which is the way most people think of. He stayed in Harvard. He tinkered with it. He got it working well. There were other competitors like, you know, Friendster at the time, but he made sure that, you know, he got it working. He developed a different kind of way of relating to each other through, you know, this social media. And, you know, then he got other colleges involved, and then it went global, and now there's like 1 billion people that are, you know, registered with Facebook. So again, he started with a small idea.
Yeah.
And so you want to think, you know, think of the small idea in the sense of being simple, focused, you know, different and relevant.
Yeah. And, if you know, for people who struggle telling their story, you have a great chapter in there on story, which unfortunately we don't have time to cover today. But there, you talk about the, you know, the groups of stories, the categories of stories.
Right.
And I want to share a story that I read, I think, yesterday. There's a site called dearphotograph.com, and this 23-year-old kid had an idea for a blog. And he just told people to get an old photograph of themselves or a place that was very they were very fond of, go back to that place and put the photograph into the scene and take a photograph of themselves shooting it. Now, it's kind of hard to explain, but if you go to the site, dearphotograph.com, right, and look, it's a beautiful, very simple concept.
Mm-hmm.
From that, he's been on just about every major media outlet.
Right.
And
right,
he got a book deal. And he said he did not pitch it. Big houses were going to him looking for a book deal from him.
Yeah.
So
you
I thought that was interesting.
It's all stories. It's like, you know,
yeah,
letters from Iwo Jima. You know, it's all these little stories that are very emotional that people are going to be telling. And it's got the visual component and these wonderful stories, you know, chicken soup, you know, that kind of wonderful idea.
Yes. Well, I want to give you the opportunity to leave our listeners with a final thought, Catherine, and on personal branding and branding in general.
Right. Well, you know, my overall thought is, you know, if you don't brand yourself, other people will. And you are your most important asset. And branding is a way to that gives you the opportunity to maximize the asset that is you and maximize your business if you're an entrepreneur. So my formula for success is hard work plus branding equals success.
There you go. And I know they can find out more about you at selfbrand.com. And what's your blog? I don't remember what
your blog. Yeah, my blog is artofbranding.com.
Artofbranding.com and selfbrand.com. And the book, again, is Breakthrough Branding, How Smart Entrepreneurs and Intrapreneurs Transform a Small Idea into a Big Brand. Catherine Caputo, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks Appreciate for including me. I loved it. Thanks.
And please do stay with us. Coming up next, we'll be joined by journalist Caitlin Kelly, and she has a fascinating story to share with us, too. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Got some flowers for you.
Thank you. They're beautiful.
Beautiful indeed, because these flowers were ordered directly from a local florist. When you go straight to the florist, the person you talk to is likely the same one who'll put together your floral arrangement and make sure it's perfect. Not like those 800 number places where the voice on the other end of the phone belongs to an order taker in a call center who collects a fee just for taking your order. Now, that's money that won't go toward flowers. Why would you pay more to get less? It takes no more than a few seconds to go online and find a neighborhood florist you can talk to directly. No middleman markup, no convenience fee, just beautiful fresh flowers delivered by a local florist. So remember, roses are red, violets are blue, and a local florist is the best choice for you.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Beautiful. Fit.
happily married and successful. Former executive Linda Krill was the kind of woman who made things happen. But after losing her husband at 57, Krill found herself in the middle of an identity crisis. You won't believe what she did to find herself again. Tune in Monday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for the author of Blind Curves on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has a new Facebook page, so you can see what's happening on our show and what we're up to between shows. Like us on Facebook and look out for upcoming contest drawings.
Lewis and Clark would be proud. We're exploring new territory on the air every day right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And as promised, we're talking with two women today who both lost their jobs when they were doing pretty well in their careers and had to kind of reinvent themselves or take different paths. And my next guest is Caitlin Kelly. She's a career print journalist in New York, most recently a staff reporter for the New York Daily News. She's been telling stories for a living since she was a sophomore at the University of Toronto. And she's written about everything from radiation to running shoes for national publications in her native Canada and later in the U.S. with More, Glamour, Business Week, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, U.S. Today, and many more. She is the author of Blown Away, American Women and Guns, and her latest book is called Mauled, My Unintentional Career in Retail. And welcome to the show, Caitlin Kelly.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I want to just share with our listeners how I first came across your work, years ago. You'd written an article about a love affair, which was very powerful, and for some reason it really touched me. And I think I've only done this maybe 3 or 4 times in my life. I emailed you and said I enjoyed your story.
Oh, that's so great.
And then not very long ago, I was in the bookstore and I was looking in the business and nonfiction sections for ideas for the show and saw this book. And then I recognized the name and put the two together. And here you are today.
Oh, that's great.
So I want to just begin with your story, because you were an award-winning journalist. You've done an extraordinary amount of things. You've traveled all over. You've been very athletic. You spent a couple of years in Paris. Just take us back through your journey a little, if you would.
Oh, thank you. Hard to sum up, but I'll try. as you said in your introduction, and thank you for that, I started writing for a living literally when I was still at university. So I've been writing for 30-plus years. And I started out in Canada, where I was born and raised, born in Vancouver. I grew up in Toronto and Montreal, and I moved to the United States in the summer of 1988, which was probably the biggest shock of my life. I've got a blog post going up about it and describe the feeling of being a raindrop falling into the ocean, just thinking, good Lord, this is such a huge country, and will I ever, you know, be anybody ever again? And it's been challenging and a lot of fun. Did have some staff jobs in New York, magazine jobs. It was really challenging. I had a great print background. I arrived in New York when I was 30, just in time for the first recession of 3. And because I speak French and Spanish, I was able to get a really good magazine job where I needed those language skills. So I'm always telling people, you know, learn another language. It gives you a really interesting edge. And over the years was freelance, went working in some magazines, as you said, worked at the Daily News from 05 to 06, and unfortunately was let go. It was, you know, the beginning of the recession for journalists. That started much earlier than for many other people. And since then, I've been freelance. So since then, I've been writing for the New York Times, a whole variety of different publications. I was a cover girl in Arthritis Today magazine. That was pretty fun in December. Isn't that the most glamorous? Yeah, it's so funny because I wrote, I'd been writing a blog for a while, and it's, you know, it's my voice. It's pretty sassy. And they found it, liked it, and said, you obviously have bad arthritis because I talked about it. And I actually had a hip replacement in early February.
Oh, wow.
And typical of how I approach my life and my finances, I've already sold 3 stories about it, one of which is on the AARP website, because I had an unusual procedure that it was just an extraordinary recovery, very quick and very painless. So typically, mauled is very similar. whatever happens to me, if I can write a story and sell it, then I'm going to do that.
Yeah, you know, I was pitched a story a little while ago and for the radio show, and I decided not to do it. And then I saw on your blog that you'd actually written about it for the New York Times.
There you go.
That was interesting.
Yeah, I write about just about everything. My family's horrified. It's like, you've got to stop.
So, you were let go from the Daily News. What was it? The New York Daily. Where are we? New York
Daily News.
Yeah. It didn't sound like it was a great match for you because you pitched a lot of stories. You wrote a lot of stories for them. And yet they you say in the book, you were very honest that they let you go because they said you were unproductive. But based on all of the writing that you have done and are doing now, it didn't sound like, you know, that tabloid was a great match for you.
And it really wasn't. No, it was. And I'm fine saying that. I mean, it just, you know, you walk in the door and you hope for the best and you try your hardest. I certainly did. And I do. And I had the front page. I had a huge exclusive. I led the New York news cycle for 24 hours, which is impossible, with the story that they gave me. And then 2 weeks later, here's the door. So, yeah, it wasn't a great fit. I'm really, really glad that I did it. For a couple of reasons, and I'm not being Pollyanna. One was, you know, when you write for the New York Times, and I love writing for the Times, you know, there's no way past it. It's a more affluent, educated audience. The Daily News median household income was something like $40,000. So I was out in Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, you know, really going into some much rougher neighborhoods, covering much grittier stories, which I really appreciated and learned a lot. I also learned to write differently. When you write for a tabloid, you know, you're sort of throat-clearing at the Times by the time you've written 500, 700 words. That's your story at the Daily News. That's all you get. So it absolutely changed the way that I think and report and write, and that's really helpful. So, no, it wasn't a great fit long-term, but a really, really good experience in changing my writing, changing how I do my interviews. The great thing, and you would know this from your show, which I learned is called Get the Quote. And once you've got the quote, you're done. You don't have to endlessly keep reporting the same thing over and over. And I found that really good, a really good advice.
Yeah. Well, it was a matter of, we just talked about branding and personal branding in particular. And, you know, it just wasn't your personal brand there.
No. So, I'm more of a broadsheet girl, as they say.
So you go back, you're freelancing, you're always freelancing, I guess, anyway, as a journalist. And you can't find another job after this as a reporter. So you decide to look for something that's part-time. And I understand this myself from being at the computer so many hours a day. You did not want a job that involved computer work. So too many options then, did it?
No, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot. Of course, it's yet another blog post. And it's, you know, it's the ultimate irony is that there was an entire generation of children raised not to sit staring at the television screen because it would melt your eyeballs and wonder what you all for a living. All of us now stare at computer screens. There's almost, you know, five jobs left that you actually don't have to stare at a screen, no matter how great the job is or how much you enjoy what you do. So absolutely, I wanted something that wasn't that. And then you think, okay, well, what's that going to be? It becomes physical labor, which I think is fine. I'm perfectly happy to do it. Do I have the skills? Well, I'm not a carpenter. I'm not a plumber. I'm not an electrician. I needed a part-time job. And I really thought, well, maybe retail, which is what Mauld is about, maybe retail is a fit for me. I'm on my feet. The product I was selling was the North Face, which is outdoor athletic clothing. I'm a jock and I travel, so great fit with the product. And I'm a people person. I get lonely. I really like to be social. I love to chat up strangers. It's what you and I do for a living. And that's really at its absolute best. If you're good at it, that's what retail is about. You're not just selling a bunch of stuff. You're really engaging a customer who walks in the door, perhaps not intending to spend a penny. And if you're good, and if you're really good, they'll probably spend a couple more pennies before you walk out. I once spent an hour talking to a customer, which is unusual, but my manager knew that was going to result in a sale. She spent $800. That was my biggest sale ever. Yeah, yeah. But I think that's the proof of the pudding, is the more that you are really authentically, you know, connecting with somebody in a store, not just like, hey, buy these sneakers, they're on special. That's not selling. That's just being obnoxious. I think retail selling is actually really interesting and takes a lot of skill.
It certainly does. I've actually done three stints myself, one when I was at college and then two stints both times when I moved to a brand new city, because it is relatively easy if you, you know, are presentable and can speak coherently to pick up a job in retail. So I understand. I did not stay very long, but it was a good starting point. So you went to North Face. You were just working part-time, right?
Right.
How long did you think this was going to last? Were you still looking for like a full-time reporter's job at the time?
That's a great question. No, I didn't look for another job. I'd really made the decision that I would just go back to freelance. Truthfully, after the Daily News, which, was somewhat bruising. I mean, if it's not a good fit, your confidence, at least mine was, you come out a little dinged.
Yeah.
And then I came out, A, a little dinged, with my confidence. B, I was 50. And C, in journalism. And D, in a recession. Not a good combination. So I just thought, I know how to freelance. I know how to make money at home. I can do that. I'll just get a part-time job to supplement my freelancing. I wasn't going to see this as this is a quick 2 or 3 weeks and then try to get back to a full-time job. I just thought, no, it's fine. And there was a part of me, however silly this sounds, that thought, maybe it's a career change. Maybe I'm going to be really good, and they'll see how good I am, and they'll promote me, which never happens. But, I was hopeful and optimistic and naive. I thought, well, let's go see how this goes. But I really need to be clear with listeners. A lot of people think, and I've been accused of this, and that really offends me, that I did it to write a book. And I want to be very clear that that's really offensive to me on several levels. I think it really demeans the extremely hard work that retail people do every day, as if the only reason one would slum it is to just go write a book. And people have used that language. And the other is the sort of notion that, well, you couldn't possibly have needed the money. Well, come check out my bank account. That's a kind of a sort of an odd way to look at somebody else's life choices. It was a really good place for me to come back into the world of work in a, frankly, I would say lower stress way. Not that it's not stressful, but it's stressful in a different way than what I've been doing since college. And that's a long time to do one thing.
Yeah. I actually found it to be very stressful myself.
Did you? Yeah.
One of the roles. The other two I was bored out of my skull, but we'll talk about that in a minute.
We're
going to go to break, and my guest in this segment is award-winning journalist Caitlin Kelly. Her new book is called Mulled, My Unintentional Career in Retail. And I'm going to ask you, before we go today, what you want to tell the guys in the suits in the corporate world.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
I didn't think it was anything.
I had pain in my abdomen. It just wouldn't go away.
I was spotting, but I had already gone through menopause.
These symptoms may be nothing, but they could be early warning signs of a gynecologic cancer, such as cervical, ovarian, or uterine cancer.
Seeing my doctor probably saved my life.
Warning signs are not the same for everyone. If you think something's wrong, see your doctor. Ask about gynecologic cancer. Call 1-800-CDC-INFO for more information. A message from the Inside Knowledge Campaign and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Cornerstone Home Lending, we cover the world of animals. This week, May 12th, it's Mother's Day, and besides that, it's a Dr. Nell's Sunday on Animal World. Gifted healer and best practitioner, Dr. Nels Rasmussen joins us in the studio. It's sure to be a great healing Sunday for you and your animal friends. We'll have open phone lines for your calls and questions, in addition to remote healings for your animal friends. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Stay informed with news, traffic, and weather at the top of the hour, weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Caitlin Kelly. She's a career print journalist who went on a little sidetrack. She took a part-time job in a mall in retail. And as a result of that, and I want to make sure We don't mislead anyone here as a result of that. She didn't do this to write the book, but as a result of it, wrote the book, Mulled My Unintentional Career in Retail. So in a way, I mean, this kind of gave your career a little boost, right? Because back into journalism, because, you know, I remember years ago reading Nora Ephron had said that her mother was a Hollywood screenwriter in the days when women did not write screenplays in Hollywood. And she'd come home brokenhearted from a date after she'd been dumped. And her mother would say to her, never mind, darling, it'll make good copy one day.
Of course. Right. Yeah. No, in a couple of ways, it was absolutely, bizarrely enough, a great decision. One, and this is really important, I think, for listeners. I'm sure some of your listeners, in fact, many of them, are maybe looking for work. They're unemployed. They're between jobs. And some people have been looking for a really long time. And one of the things that's really, I think, undiscussed is the emotional need for work, which is a place to go that they want you. So that was really important to rebuild my confidence. I mean, being fired, you know, let go, laid off, whatever you want to say, it hurts. You know, even if it's not a great fit at a job, I lost a very good salary. You know, I'm not 23. It was not going to be easy, and I knew that. So to be able to just show up every Tuesday and have a manager who liked me and coworkers who I think liked me as well and some customers who really appreciated me, that was terrific. And yeah, I've got an agent. I got into my second book. I've gotten some very nice speaking engagements, ironically, at retail conferences. I get to speak to senior executives.
Oh, interesting.
Not that anybody would listen when I had the uniform on, but now that I'm out of the game and I'm willing to speak truth to power, people have paid me very well to come and say, listen, here are some ways we could do this better. So it's been an interesting transition.
Yeah. Now, just even going for the job interview was an experience for you because you were used to going to formal job interviews where you had to sell yourself, and this was totally different.
Right. It was really funny. I was incredibly nervous. I'd interviewed with the New York Times. I mean, I'd interviewed with Time and Newsweek, and here I was going for, you know, less than $10 an hour potentially, and thinking, I don't even know what to wear. What do you say? And being very, very aware, I was then 50, that the resume that I had from my journalism was not the resume to present. And again, I want to be practical for listeners, and this is, I think, a very useful tip. I sat down and thought really hard about what my transferable skills were. And I wrote a one-sheet resume, and I just said, okay, I've traveled the world, I speak fluent French, I speak good Spanish, I've done the following sports, there must be 20 sports. I mean, I was interviewing at an international company that was equipping people to either travel or to do athletic activities. So I thought, well, here, I know how to do this, and oh, by the way, what do I do as a journalist? I chat up strangers. It's exactly what you do in retail. So I was very thoughtful in presenting myself as somebody who would have skills that I could start using the minute I got on the sales floor, never having worked retail, because most of the people I was competing with had a lot of retail, even the 22-year-old kids. They've been doing it since high school.
Mm-hmm. And so you get the job, and you're paid, what, like $9 an hour? And
$11. They offered $9, and I just
Oh, that's right.
No. Yeah. They offered $9. I said, I can't do it. You got to give me $11, which is the most they were offering. And I still couldn't believe that I was going to show up for that kind of money because it was just so shockingly little. And we had to pay to park. So I would lose an hour of my labor for the privilege of parking at the mall because every single person at the mall had to pay.
Shocking. That's shocking.
It was, really, yeah.
You know, here's the thing that surprised me. You sent out 48 resumes applying for nonprofit communications or writing positions, you know, because you couldn't find anything reporting. Didn't hear anything back. And yet you go for this job in retail. You end up staying there 2 years and 3 months. That really, that surprised me.
I think it surprised a lot of people, and there's a couple of reasons for that. And again, I'm being very personal to admit this, you know, publicly, which is in the book.
Right.
You know, when you work alone at home, it's lonely, it's isolating, I don't have kids. It was a place to go that I enjoyed. I mean, for the longest time, I actually just really liked my job. I liked my manager a lot. I liked my coworkers. When customers were interesting, they were so much fun and so intriguing. I had Chilean psychologists. I had visitors from Finland. I had people from France. It was a really interesting mix. If you're somebody who enjoys people, I think retail can be actually a terrific, terrific job, even part-time, because I really enjoy talking to people and hearing their stories, and that is how you end up selling quite effectively because you engage them. So I stayed a long time, and frankly, the recession was hitting really hard. As I describe in the book, it was almost like being sort of on a ship at sea and sort of staring out through the porthole at the approaching gale going, oh, my God, I'm not leaving, seriously. And, you know, there's a moment in the book I describe where a friend of mine comes in. There's a very powerful moment. It was the June of, I think, 2008, perhaps, or 2009. And I was literally having a pity party at the back of the store. I was going through jackets, lining them in order, which is really boring, and just saying over and over like a mantra, I have to quit, I have to quit, I have to quit. Nobody could hear me, thank God. And a friend walks in the door of the store. She's my age, and she had used to have a very good job in journalism. She's doing the census. Now, the census was a good job. It was $18 an hour or $21 if you were a manager. That's really good money compared to 11, right?
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't even get a job at the census. I speak Spanish, I had managerial experience, but I'm not a citizen. Citizens
oh,
first.
Okay.
Couldn't even get a job at the census. And she said, Caitlin, there are CEOs working with me. Yeah. People out there in this recession are so badly injured, you cannot imagine who's working for $18 an hour. So I would just look out the door of our little store and say, I think I'll stay. So until I could replace the income, which I did, I got a blogging job, bizarrely enough, that paid more than my store income. And at that point, which is, it took me 6 months to do it, then I said, I'm gone.
Yeah.
Now I can afford to leave, but not until I'd replaced the income, which on a good month was $250, $300 a month. That's significant. That was gas and grocery money for me that I needed.
Right, right. You have to do what you have to do. I understand
yep.
that. I've been there myself. Here's the thing as well. I mean, I used to be a VP in a bank, and we had tellers with master's degrees. This was years ago when there was no economical crisis.
Right.
But so, I mean, you know, just because you have a degree in something doesn't always mean you can find work in it. And I read here that you're a grad of University of Toronto, which is equivalent to Canada's Harvard, right?
Yep, it's the best school in the country. But, you know, let's be honest with each other. And, again, lots of listeners can identify with, you know, either they're in the situation or their kids have just graduated with, you know, $50,000 in student debt, and they can't get a job. And people have this assumption, well, if you went to college, you can get a job. Really? No, not necessarily, depending on your skill set, depending where you live. And I won't mince words, depending on your age. I was 50. It is much, much more difficult, depending on your skill set, to find a really well-paid job over the age of 45 or 50. Look at every story in any media outlet about the long-term unemployed, and I've noticed that they're almost always people in their 50s.
Yeah.
So I think there are a number of factors. I don't think just having a great college degree, which I have, is necessarily the answer. I think it's your skills. I think it's your willingness to move. It might be your willingness to say, oh, I'll make half of what I used to make, no problem, which I can do freelance. I had a big drop in income after I lost my job. It was very rough. I went down to 25% of my income. That was very hard. And now it's back to almost 50%. Again, with no kids and a low overhead, I can do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not loving it, but, you know, we're not homeless. I'm appreciative that I can pay my bills and still save. So
right.
Things are better than they were.
Right. Adaptability.
That's the word, let me tell you, in this economy.
So I know part of the reason you wrote the book, and you share a lot of information about this, and you, as you said, you talk about it and you blog about it, it is to shine a light on what it's like to be a retail worker. Because I know from working in retail banking and my three very short stints in retail that these employees are often abused by customers, by managers. What did you see? What did you experience as being the most stressful situation in that environment?
That's a great question. There are many. There's a chapter in the book called Customers from Hell. So I don't name names, but I give some specific examples. I think the biggest challenge, and it's very real for anybody in retail, is you get caught in a squeeze play between corporate expectations where they set a very high sales goal. Sometimes my sales goal was $6,000 in a 7-hour shift. That's a lot of merch, because I'm not selling $1,500 bags at Vuitton. I'm selling $30 ski hats or, you know, $150 jackets, $6,000. So you've got a squeeze play from corporate saying, these are the numbers we expect you to meet, right? You got to do this for us. And the customers who are stamping their feet and chatting on their cell phones, and their kids are running around the store and screaming and dropping Coca-Cola, and you're just thinking, I just can't, this is just not going to work. Where's the pleasure here? And the challenge becomes almost overwhelming when the pressures get higher and higher. Customers in the recession, have become consistently more unpleasant. And I've seen this in talking to retail executives. I had one person at a conference I spoke to who said he's seeing a very real spike in the abuse that his associates are receiving from customers. He said he doesn't see as much, but when customers go a little crazy, they're really out of control.
Right.
And we saw this in the store. Our team was 15 people on the sales floor. It was a small store, it was a small group. But as the recession hit, you know, we're all human beings. People are spending money they don't really have, or they're scared they're going to lose their job, or their kids have overspent. You know, can I really afford to do this? And so they'll take it out on the associate because the associate can't fight back,
right,
which is
right.
really ugly. And it is very abusive.
Right, it
you
is.
Know,
it is.
Yelling at an associate is completely ridiculous, and it's very rude because the associate has no authority and has no power. If you don't like something in the store environment, and many of us don't, including myself, you write to the CEO, you write to the VP of marketing, you write to public relations, you tweet it, you blog it, you put it on Facebook.
Yeah.
Yelling at an associate is like kicking a dog. It's just unfair, and it's unhelpful, and it's unkind.
Right.
It doesn't accomplish anything.
Caitlin, we're right at the end of our segment. There's a great article which you sent to me. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go through it, but I just want to let listeners know it was in the New York Times on June 23rd, and it's talking about Apple's retail army. And, you know, I'm sure this is not an uncommon event throughout retail stores, but it's talking about how little pay they get for the amount of profits that they bring into companies.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so what's the best site for people to reach you? Because I've got 20 seconds left here.
Oh, thank you so much. Malled the Book, M-A-L-L-E-D, thebook.com.
All right.
My direct email is there. I would love to hear from readers and listeners anytime. That would be a real thrill.
Great. Thank you so much. And malledthebook.com. The book is called Mulled My Intentional Career in Retail by Caitlin Kelly. And if you missed any part of today's show, it'll be up on podcast tomorrow. Hopefully tomorrow, maybe Wednesday. But you can find out more at conversationslive.net. You can reach me at info@conversationslive.net. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.